The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
The following is a conversation between Mario Marino, chairman of the Marino Institute, and Denver Frederick, host of The Business of Giving, on AM 970 The Answer in New York City.
If you were to take a poll and ask people who they considered to be the Renaissance man or woman of the nonprofit world, I suspect that my next guest just might be the top vote-getter. He has the uncanny ability to connect disparate dots, a holistic understanding of what it takes to create a high-performing organization that has real impact, and the ability to communicate that in an informative and engaging way. He is Mario Marino, the founder of Venture Philanthropy Partners, author of Leap of Reason, and chairman of the Marino Institute. Good evening, Mario, and welcome to the Business of Giving.
Thank you, Denver.
There is so much to talk about with you, but first give us a brief overview of the Marino Institute and of its mission.
The Marino Institute, I'm going to be crazy, doesn't have a specific mission, per se. It's a holding organization, honestly. We have something called Marino Group, which is our for-profit, and which is only for holding investments in the Marino Institute. And we use those as two entities to sort of turn and work on whatever problem we want to work on.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't mean to say that we don't have a mission, but there is no – if you looked at my life mission, there is none. It's basically to live
mission.
Life well. So consequently – but what put us – it's somehow, without realizing it, I ended up doing what I do in the for-profit, non-profit world, what I did in the corporate. We work on issues of performance and how organizations function.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, the Marino Institute has been an incubator for a lot of different – efforts over the years.
Right. You know, you've had a couple major stops in the world of philanthropy. After your life as a software entrepreneur, you sold your company back in 1995 for $1.7 billion, which was a record at the time. One of those stops would be Venture Philanthropy Partners. But for those listeners who might not be familiar with the term venture philanthropy, of which you're a pioneer, how would you describe it for them?
First of all, the concept of venture philanthropy was popularized in the late 90s, but I'd argue it was probably recognized by and done by David Rockefeller
mm-hmm.
decades before, and I didn't have the smarts to understand that at the time. But if you take the big picture and you separate it from all the jargon in the field, it's taking what I call an investment approach to an organization. And by that I mean not a financial approach, but looking at an organization that you think has potential to get more effective. But you see that through the eyes of the CEO and the board. What you give them or you bring to the table is significant capital.
Mm-hmm.
You give that to them over a multi-year period of time, multiple horizons, so you can stay with them. You bring significant strategic assistance to the table to not change their mission, but to help them achieve that mission. And so the key elements are multi-year financing, significant capital, shared visions to success, in the realization that you're there to help that leader, not to dominate the leader.
Yeah, real.
That's, by the way, is not the typical definition of venture philanthropy.
Okay? Absolutely. But it's real and deep engagement,
yeah,
isn't it?
Right, very much.
So in 2000, you and a couple of others, including Mark Warner, the senator of Virginia, started Venture Philanthropy Partners, and this was a place you could really put into practice a number of those core beliefs. Tell us about that organization and the area of the country that it served.
Venture Philanthropy Partners exists today under the leadership of President and CEO Carol Thompson Cole, doing some great work, which we can touch on as hopefully we get into the discussion. But we created the organization in 2000. After spending 2 years in the field,
mm-hmm.
sort of trying to get a handle of what was going on.
Yeah, you did your due diligence.
Well, yeah. And I always come back and say, if we did that, we realized we didn't do enough. I mean, you always come back to that.
Right.
But I stumbled out of the gate the first 4 or 5 years. It was tough. A lot of stuff we thought were the right things. We learned. We got our lunch handed to us a number of times, a number of areas. And what we learned was that a lot of the so-called business discipline had to be blended. You couldn't just come in directly with those concepts. And I think that's the mistake so many people make today. And I think over the 5 or 6 years of that initial experience, we learned how to blend the concept of business discipline, and I shouldn't say business, good discipline, with some of the mores of how the nonprofit sector actually operates. That would be the essence. The biggest thing we learned was the importance of navigating regional ecosystems and knowing how to work through sort of the cultural issues, the ethnic issues of areas, the jurisdictional issues of areas, because that's how you got things done.
Mm-hmm.
And I think many people don't take the time to map out the space and knowing who has to be touched, involved, work with, et cetera. Mapping that ecosystem and navigating, I think, was the single biggest lesson we learned in the first 10 years.
Yeah, that's really very interesting, because I do think there's a lot of us who think that it can be very formulaic. It worked here, it will work over there.
Right.
And that just never seems to work, because
Agreed.
You're not responding to the environment and meeting people where they are. You're trying to force your point of view on them.
Well, it gets. I'll use an example. You mentioned Senator Warner. Great respect. But we held a meeting November 5th, 1999. In fact, Billy Shore, a number of people. It was a great group in the meeting. And I remember we talked about putting in a learning center. And in those days, if you went back to the 90s, learning centers were putting computer technology into centers where kids could get at them. And there was a person in New York who actually, the woman and I got in a number of significant, let's say, debates, talked about how they could put these up in 2 weeks. And of course, two of my colleagues in business people said, of course it'd be done in 2 weeks. I said, no, you're missing the point. This takes at least a year to 18 months. And I said, what do you mean? I said, putting the computers in is the last thing you worry about. I said, it's engaging in that community, in that neighborhood, figuring out the right place to put it, working with, you know, the community leaders to get them to come in. Yeah, that's where the workplace is. That's 12 to 18 months, and everybody's looking at me like I'm crazy. But that's the world.
Yeah,
people don't want to take the time. Everybody's after silver bullets. You got to take the time to engage the community and find the right people to work with.
Yeah, I mean, I sometimes find that in fundraising, which is so often the last link of the chain. And you have to then begin to go back to the organization and say, we have some problems here or issues that we need to solve. You can't just magically
right.
go and ask somebody for money and that will fix all your problems. But that, again, is the silver bullet that you're talking about.
Right.
Well, tell us a little bit about Venture Philanthropy Partners today. They're in the greater Washington metro area and some of the work that they're doing.
Yeah, a number of things. It's been fairly successful. I mean, we've now, I don't know the exact number. I apologize for this. Let me explain my role today. I want to give credit to the current leadership. Carol Thompson Cole has been president of CEO now probably since 2007, 2008. Dear friend, great leader, very different than myself, you know, in terms of context. And she's built on what we did originally significantly. Today, they're probably doing one of the seminal projects in what people call collaborative investment. One of the issues, just to step back off this for a second, one of the criticisms I have today of everybody trying to find these collective solutions for communities is they don't want to spend the time to build the relationships to mm-hmm. build them. To Carol's credit, and I'm going to go back to Carol, in 2000 when we formed VPP, Venture Philanthropy Partners, we had a very unpopular position that funding, solving D.C.'s problems was risking solving yesterday's problem. Because we could see the gentrification coming.
Mm-hmm.
And the poverty was moving into Prince George's County in mm-hmm. Maryland and down the Route 1 corridor in Virginia. Today, that's exactly where those poverty sections are. Well, Carol also saw that. And Carol started working the Prince George's County back in 2005. And the reason I bring this up is the amount of time that's been spent building relationships. Today, Venture Philanthropy Partners has a program called Ready for Work. It's in partnership with the county government,
yep.
the county school systems. The Wegman grocery system to their Hillside. Hillside Agency is one of the finest worker entry programs in the country. And also a number of the nonprofits that Venture Philanthropy has worked with. And they're all working together around a common issue of getting this what they call disconnected youth, 18 to 24, back into the mainstream either to get into where they have an employable opportunity or change their mindset to move on to college. I think, you know, is it going to be successful? Do we know that? Hard to say. However, if you step back and look at the process by which they've gotten there, the amount of time they've invested on building the relationships, finding the right partners to the table, crossing sector, you see check all the boxes.
Yeah.
I think it's one of the best models I've seen to actually go in and see the collaborative process can work, but it takes remarkable discipline and remarkable time in the community.
Yeah, well, you got a good eye for that. And what a problem that is. I think we have about 5 million young people in this country in that age range who are neither employed or going to school.
Right.
And there's about 350 million of those around the world. So that is a big problem. Well, in 2011, you published Leap of Reason, Managing to Outcomes in an Era of Scarcity, one of the most influential books that the sector has ever seen. I read it when it came out, I remember. I was urged to by so many people. What was the essential message you were trying to communicate through this book, Mario?
Not to give you a winding answer, it actually changed.
Mm-hmm.
The first message was about the issue of what I call, not the fallacy, but the short-sighted nature of outcomes. And the reason the book got written, and again, you can do it as you want to say, I was in 3 different meetings in my usual blunt face. I got so pissed off in the three meetings because it was different parties of people talking about how what the nonprofit leaders should do and what measures they should use. And as an ex-CEO, I thought to myself, I'm really offended that someone else would be telling me what to do. And I always remember that. We published an article called Outcomes Can't See the Forest from the Trees.
Mm-hmm.
And the point is, you're getting at, people were looking at a piece of the puzzle as opposed to understanding, yeah, you're looking at an outcome or result, but to get there takes a lot of different things, not just one thing. And that was our point, you can't see the forest from the trees. It really changed from being a book about outcomes, being a book, if you look at it, it's actually a book about management. The
other thing.
And what happened is we're very iterative when we write or do things. And we kept getting good feedback or criticism. And what happened, the piece that put it together was actually the chapter 3, the culture piece. Because we had different pieces in place. And a friend of mine said, he says, why don't you just, how do you put the glue together? And I finally just sort of, we said, well, the glue is always the culture of the organization. But, and I should also point out, that this was not just written by me. I mean, I was one of 12 people.
You were the lead writer, but there were a bunch of
people.
But
I mean, it was a number of people who really contributed. But the book went from being about outcomes, the importance of outcomes, to really being about the importance of how the role management plays. And I mean management with the big M, not in a sort of Drucker sense, sense. What that does in terms of getting to the results of how nonprofits actually can help and benefit to those they serve.
So after that, you wanted to animate the ideas, and you formed this Leap of Reason Ambassador Community. Now, this is an invitation-only group made up of over 150 truly exceptional individuals who possess great knowledge and wisdom about the sector. What is their charge, and what has their impact been?
Good question. We wrestle with this every day. I'd like to say, again, it was myself and, again, a lot of others. I want to give a reason why we started it. We did the book. I actually felt guilty right away because I had been out of action for a couple of years. And I wanted to make sure that what we wrote about...
You're a restless guy, you know.
Yeah. But I want to make sure what we wrote about was real. So we visited about 20 sites in 2012. You mentioned culture. One of the sites I visited was Youth Villages in Memphis.
Sure.
They write the book on culture in the field.
They have
a phenomenal organization.
Mm-hmm.
So, but what was good for me was that I went and was able to confirm in a number of these organizations that what we wrote about was real. You could achieve it. You wanted to be able to say, yeah, this is real stuff, you know. And what happened, though, and then after that, we kept getting requests, and we realized that there was sort of an aftermarket to the book. We were surprised. We literally thought that when we did the book, 90 days later, I was going to be off doing something else, honest to goodness. But we kept getting this reaction, so we figured we want to tap it in some way. I've always had another element, which went back to when I first broke into the field in 92. I was always perplexed why the sector, and I'll use the term at that time, never understood flexible networks. And what I mean by that is if you go back to manufacturing eras, I mean, and of course the movie industry is classic, where small organizations come together and they're able to share resources and they're able to connect to create these networks. The nonprofit sector is designed almost to use this, and it's never taken place.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So, and it's a form of, you get a little Flash Gordonish, it's the concept of online community. And I always wanted to basically pose that as a way to help leaders. So those two forces came together. We joined a few other people. But the point was always, the original purpose of the community, and it's still the purpose today, is that you have to shift minds that performance matters.
Yep.
And it sounds crazy. And everybody says, well, of course they do. The reality is that's lip service. It's that simple. You can't get solutions until a leader in a board shift their attitudes and minds that they're going to solve that problem, deal with it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what the community is about, shifting people's minds that performance of an organization actually matters. Mission and performance are inextricably linked.
Mm-hmm. As you said, it sounds simple, but it's always the simple stuff that makes a difference and people just sort of gloss over. Well, one of the things that this community has done is they built a framework called Performance Imperative, or PI. And there's a tool around that as well. How is this helping nonprofits? And maybe you can give us an example of one who's actually used this to better their organization and their mission.
Well, when we created the organization, we came together. There was only at that time about 50 ambassadors. We call them ambassadors.
Mm-hmm.
And we said, in order to go forward, what is high performance? And if you actually do research, you cannot find a definition of a high-performance organization. You'll get it for a high-performance team, but not for an organization, even in the private sector.
Hmm.
And so we took it upon ourselves, and again, it was a group of people came together to, first of all, establish a definition, which we think is maybe the most important part of the performance imperative piece. And that definition, if I'll say it generally speaking, was that a sign of a high-performing organization is someone who, over a prolonged period of time, is able to produce meaningful, measurable, financial, sustainable results for the people or causes they serve.
Mm-hmm.
But that point is, over a long period of time, meaningful, measurable, financially sustainable results. Those are very key words to what makes a high-performing organization. And then we came away to said, and what would take what would be required to get there? And we came away with what we call seven organizational disciplines or pillars. It's leadership, it's management, it's program, it's financial health, it's culture, it's continuous improvement, it's evaluation. But so that's the framework. And there's nothing startling new about it, but what I think is important that what the people who did this put it together is the succinct nature of it. Basically, in 12 pages, you capture the essence, and I mean this without being ridiculous and common. You know, go back to Deming and Drucker and Collins and Peters and Covey. I mean, it's in the 12 pages.
It's crystallized.
It's crystallized.
Mm-hmm.
So when you get to people, now I'm going to use one example. I'm very close to a school in Ohio who I was very involved in called the Lawrence School. It's for kids who learn differently. And it was blessed with a great leadership team. They applied it internally. They applied the performance imperative. In fact, they will tell you they've lived it. Okay, and their head of school, who just stepped down, Lou Salsa, oftentimes referred to it. They'd use it with board discussions. They'd use it to bring people together on issues. And here in New York City, the Einhorn Family Charitable Trust, before we even knew it, was actually using the seven we call them pillars, to have dialogues with their grantees to understand where they could best help that grantee strengthen to be high performing. So there's two examples of it, one from a funder, one from a nonprofit.
You know, one of those pillars is external evaluation for mission effectiveness. Boy, that is so important. Is that becoming more prevalent? I mean, are organizations starting to do this, and are funders starting to fund for it?
Well, funders have been funding evaluation for decades. That's the reality. The trouble is they've been funding it for themselves. I don't mean that. I mean, if you look back at the several decades, the funding community has done remarkable work in evaluation, but the evaluation was to inform the funder, not really the grantee, per se. That's changing to a certain degree. But there's huge debate in the field about the issue of evaluation, where it takes place. And without getting into that debate, my consensus is that, I mean, my own personal view, taking somewhat simplistic, is an external view is important from the day you start. But this is my DNA. I mean, it's the way out. You're always looking for some degree of external assessment, whether it's informal, whatever you use your formal terms for it. But there comes a point where it has to become formal. And the argument we made in there, and whether it's an RCT or something equivalent to a random control trial, when you're asking for significant money from either the private sectors or public sectors, you have a responsibility to yourself and to those people to prove that what you're doing works.
Yep.
You know, how are you going to do it? But that's the bottom line. You have to prove that what you're doing works. And the reality is there's a lot of stuff that isn't, without being disparaging, isn't what it's billed to be.
Right.
Period.
Mm-hmm.
And you want to make sure, you referenced some people today. Like, look at the track record of the Adam O'Connell Clark Foundation. Many of their grantees are some of the best nonprofits in the field today. But they've been able to demonstrate that what they've done really works. Pat Lawler, Youth Villages, Molly Baldwin, Roca. I mean, you go down Hillside Agencies.
Yeah.
You see tangible results. You see improved lives, better communities. I mean, that's what you're after.
Yeah. They all took the long view. There's no question about it. You know, as we both know, Mario, funders often demand results from their grantees and pretty much just leave it at that. What should they be asking the grantee instead that could help better assure that they'll see these results that they so covet?
Let me hedge the answer first, because it depends what the foundation or the donor wants, first of all. I mean, all honesty. In some cases, they're really just driving their agenda, in effect contracting to certain nonprofits to pull their mission off.
Mm-hmm.
And their concern for those nonprofits is different. They're taking a higher level view. I'm not saying that's right or wrong. Where there's others who are actually working through the nonprofit. And I think there's a difference in orientation. It's the latter cases where... Well, in both of those cases, I think what's transpired, it's not, may not be popular comment, but there's probably been an over-focus on funders wanting information from their grantees, but not being willing to put the support in place for those grantees to pull that information correctly. Mm. And in fact, many times, that multiple funders hitting one grantee actually creates a lot of confusion, a lot of, the overhead they're all complaining about. So the thing I do is whether it's someone like Einhorn, Janice Rothberg's work, or Fred Ali's work, where there's more of an empathy for the grantee. and a time taken to understand what the grantee's trying to do. Don't try to change what the grantee's trying to do, but find out, pick those grantees where you agree with that mission, and then figure out how can you help that grantee get stronger, better, more effective, so they can be more effective for those they serve. That, to me, is the magic. But that take again, it takes an expertise in the program managers, program officers. It takes time to learn more about the grantee, and we tend not to go that deep.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. So they want the results, but they don't take the time to say, what do you need to be able to produce those results?
Right.
And let the grantee tell you what those are.
I mean, if I could step back, you mentioned venture philanthropy partners. When the team goes in, there's always an initial planning phase. And it's not something to be imposed. It's meant to be not for us. What we're trying to do is establish a process by which the organization will put a mirror to its face, come to its own conclusions about what it needs to be better. Not us.
Yeah.
They do that.
Mm-hmm.
Once you get that point, then everything starts. Then we can kick in. Then we can kick in with funding. We can kick in with assistance. But unless they believe it, our role doesn't count.
Mm-hmm.
You got to get them to believe it first. Then you got a game.
That's the way pretty much all of life works, as a matter of fact, I think I found out. You know, you have wonderful insights, Mario, on a whole host of different topics that impact the sector, and I want to get your take on a couple of them. The CEOs I speak to often cite to me as their number one problem, they're bored. Boy, is that a common concern. What have you learned about nonprofit boards, and what advice do you have for the leaders of these organizations?
Wow, we could spend the next 7 days, again, carefully watching my comments, but I mean, most nonprofit boards are dysfunctional.
Yeah.
I mean, just say it as it is.
Mm-hmm.
There are some good ones.
That saved us 4 days right there.
And I think there's a lot of reasons for it. I mean, first, I think a lot of leaders don't know how to put boards together.
Mm-hmm.
Let's start, you know, you're not taught that. You're not, you know, you don't spend the time doing that type of thing. Two, a lot of people grow up with very negative views of boards. And so they're by definition, they're working with a board defensively as opposed to in a constructive. I've been blessed. In my life, I was just phenomenal boards.
Yeah.
Boy, they saved my
ass. Well, you made a lot of that happen, too.
Well, but in all fairness, I mean, the time I spent with General Atlantic and Steve Denning, chairman there, you know, we're good friends. I mean, the focus on getting boards that were strong, which would push back in a constructive way, which push you out of your comfort zone. Those are what you want in a board. You want a board you can confide in. You're going to want a board you can tell your worst problem to, and they're going to help you, not stab you in the back.
Yeah.
That's what. Then you have a good board.
Mm-hmm.
But getting that relationship between management and the board is so tough in the field today. And the other thing is a lot of people go on boards, and they don't expect to work.
No, not hard work at least.
Well, they're going on for a different reason. I was, you know, if I could, my first experience, I won't name who it was, I went on a board, and I didn't know any better. It was my first time, and the woman, remarkable human being. I love being around her. Great insight. I go to my first meeting, and the chairman and the ED are like at each other's throats. I'm thinking, what did I get into? And I didn't say anything. And I'm sitting there because I didn't know what I should do. I came from this other world, and I didn't know my traction. I think a lot of people go in, and they're saying they don't know what to do yet. And when you should be asking the hard question, you say, well, is that my role yet? A lot of people check their brains at the door. That's the best way you can say it. They check. And they check their courage at the door.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That's even more important. They don't want to ask the really hard question.
Yeah, I've had that experience myself, and I've always wondered, how do they run their companies? Because they get very passive. And I must say, it seems that what I've been able to observe, too, is that a lot of times CEOs are so desperate for a yes, they don't really tell the board member what's expected of them.
Right.
And then when they're disappointed, the board member is saying, well, I'm doing what they asked me to do. But they tried too hard for that, yes, and that's a big mistake.
But you're saying something there. That shows that there's a lack of ongoing communication in working between the board and the leadership. And you want to have more of a seamless relationship, not this distance, you know, I'm going to meet you once every 3 months. You want a dialogue on it. So there's no surprises.
Mm-hmm.
And people are involved. And again, boards can be remarkably constructive and helpful. That's the reality of it.
Yeah, you need them. Let me ask you about talent, something which I know you're very keen on. And there's some real competition coming from purpose-driven businesses. And according to nonprofit HR, however, 2/3 of nonprofits have no talent acquisition strategy. And then a full 56% said, we have no plans of ever getting one. How do you believe organizations need to start thinking about talent and hiring?
I'll try to answer in two ways. One is, forget plans, forget anything that's grandiose. The people you hire are the most important thing you do.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, forget all the big strategy for a minute. And for some reason, we've beaten the field down to not think that way. We want to get somebody who can we can afford as opposed to the right person. We oftentimes are too kind in how we make those judgments. We've created the environment that we don't encourage the executive director or the president to go after the best talent. There's no one on the board advising that. No one helping them with that thought process. And sometimes comp is a factor. I mean, there's a whole bunch of reasons to go into this not going after the right people. There's a degree of, I'll say it politely, mediocrity in the field right in this space because oftentimes we just don't take the extra step to go from the average to the good on the higher.
Mm-hmm.
It's that simple. Forget all the great strat. I mean, I'm talking management 101, blocking and tackling. Just start there. Just within the culture of the organization, with the culture board, make sure you're always taking your best shot on the person you're bringing in. Cry once. Cry the first time. Don't cry multiple times thereafter, right?
Yeah.
I think then, yeah, do you need a talent strategy? Sure. I mean, there's no question over time. But the reality is just make it management 101. Get the best people you can get in.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit more about culture because you touched on that a few moments ago. And I think you said that you may not have been the best manager in the world. You're not sure of that. But you are a damn good culture guy. How do you describe corporate culture? And what does it take to have a healthy and a robust one?
Well, in my life, getting into the culture, I think, was totally accidental. It's more of a we live the experience more than anything else. I think, first of all, leadership has to walk the talk. You can't. I use an example in the firm. If there was a piece of paper on the floor, I would watch to see who would pick it up.
Hmm.
Person who cares picks it up.
Yep.
Person doesn't care.
It's not my job.
It sounds stupid, doesn't it? But I think what you want to see.
But very telling.
Very telling. You want to have an environment where without respect, there can't be a culture,
mm-hmm.
first of all. People have to feel involved. They have to feel what they're doing means something. There has to be a degree of fairness in that process. They have to know that leadership cares about them. These, to me, are all elements of positive culture. There has to be a degree of performance in there, that it just can't be all kumbaya and harmonious. They have to know there's a degree of accountability is the wrong term, but execution, it counts.
Mm-hmm.
But you want the people doing it because they care. You want, most anything, when we watch, somebody has to care. They have to be cared. You want people who are curious. You want people who are going to push you in a constructive way. You don't need people with sharp elbows. Okay, you need people with soft elbows who get the job done. But they come together. You want egos left at the door.
Mm-hmm.
You want people who can get behind a shared vision. They can work with somebody. I don't care if they're going to lick stamps that day or go on a major meeting. But you want that open culture and attitude. But I think all those things go into making a what I'll call a constructive, healthy culture.
Yeah, sort of a whatever it takes attitude up
right.
and down the organization.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
Let's talk about this overhead quandary that plagues the sector. Donors and even some watchdog groups, they want those contributions to go to program and not to overhead. And frankly, it can be pretty tough trying to raise money if you got a very, very high so-called overhead. On the overhead is paying for talent.
Mm-hmm.
It's paying for leadership development. Might mean paying for a new IT system. People talk and talk about this. Is there any escaping this paradox?
It's a great question. Ironically, I just had an email exchange in the last 24 hours with a colleague that got stung on the same exact subject. We just published a piece, and he posted inside. Somebody said, he said, well, what about their performance? What about their overhead? And this is the guy who used to be my CFO, for Christ's sake. And so
you trained him.
I went back, and I said, Jim, I said, when we would go to acquire somebody, what were we looking at? When we're looking at their position in the marketplace, when we look at the quality of their product, when we look at the relationship with their customers, when we're looking at how they were perceived in the field, I said, and when we got into the overhead, weren't we missing the game? Every time we started a deal by looking at the numbers, didn't we screw it up
mm-hmm.
instead of looking at the end result? I says, that's the problem in the field today.
You're
looking over it. You're looking at the wrong thing. You should have been asking how effective they are, how many people are they really serving over time. Start there with your discussion. Then come back and look at the numbers afterwards. But
mm-hmm.
don't start with that discussion. You block people. Why do you care? If they're really good, what do you care if they've got a high overhead for? As long as it's justifiable. Now, do you want three cups of tea? Hell no. Do you want these absurd? Do you want to make
right.
sure those things happen? But that just takes some due diligence.
And then he
referenced, I won't name it, he referenced the board he was on, how he got messed up. And I said, well, all you had to do was you got seduced by the names.
Mm.
If you had just picked up the sheets and looked under the covers and asked any of your friends, they would have told you how screwed up that place was. And you didn't do your due diligence, right? So, I mean, you know, let's put the blame where the blame is. I think the overhead thing is something that's pushed so out of proportion in the field today. And I think we should be looking at one thing. what do you have to do to run and manage a good organization? And, and the point I'm saying this is, I don't think management is understood. That's the problem.
You're a Cleveland kid, through and through and through. Big fan of the Cavaliers, the Indians, the Browns. How did your childhood inform your philanthropy, both your approach to it and the causes that you support?
It's a good question, and I go through this a lot. Philanthropy, to me, is a very highfalutin word. You know? When we grew up, I used to say we were poor. We were poor not in the sense of today. I mean, we were not in poverty.
Yeah.
Huge, huge difference. But, you know, my mother cleaned houses. My mother cleaned offices. My dad sold sweepers door to door sometimes. I would go do odd jobs. I would work with my mom and stuff. We always had food, though. We always had a roof over our head. I mean, that's the difference. I mean, but we didn't have – money was not something we had. But I always described that I was rich and everything else.
Yeah, that's
you
great.
Know. And I even look back. I mean, there's guys I played ball with, guys I went to school with. Some guys serve time, right? That's the nature of the world you come from.
Yeah.
I think we look back at those areas with two, you know, sort of rose-colored glasses. But there was always a sense of giving in the family. That, if I went back to look at a thing – if somebody was sick, there were times that I had four cousins living in my bedroom because they were out of work in Pennsylvania and they would drive to Cleveland. My mother, we always had people at the table. If someone was going to, they talk about, you know, a barn building. If someone was going to build a garage, guess what? Everybody on Saturday was over there building the garage together. We didn't know what national service was. We didn't, you know, you did things because it was a natural act. I think it's that simple. Mm-hmm. And so for me, whether it's been in my business life or here, you're just I don't want to – it's not about giving back. It's not about playing forward. It's about doing – it's doing what you think is right at a point in time, okay. Period.
There you go. Let me close with this, Mario. We have seen industry after industry disrupted. Media, music, retail for sure, and maybe banking. Maybe that is already being disrupted. Do you believe there's a major disruption that's going to occur in the nonprofit sector? And if you do, any feelings what the future might look like in that regard?
Well, I'm not sure about the future. It's always hard to predict. The nonprofit sector, at the end of the day, is still a reflection of what's going on around it.
Yeah.
And the disruption is staggering. We've been on this kick for more than a few years now because the degree of major change, like you just referenced the banking industry, well, that disruption has been taking – that's been in place well over the last few years. That's been going on for a long time. But if you step back and you look at the incredible pace of change of technology, the impact of globalization, people, well, what does a globalization have to do with nonprofit? It has a lot to do with the day-to-day life of people in that community. You look at the economic breakdowns, the hollowing out of the middle class that's taking place. Just take that alone. That means we now have many more people who need more services, okay? At the same time, there's fundamental cuts occurring on almost every level of our society. So you have a natural conflict coming of a supply-demand problem of major proportions.
Mm-hmm.
That's the unfortunate, that's the scary playoff. And if you pick up any newspaper and look at what's happening to city budgets, county budgets, federal budgets, they're going down. They're getting cut.
Right.
In the meantime, and there was an article I used this morning. There was a guy who was making $19 an hour 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Today, he's now making $11 an hour, and he's been stagnant for 4 years.
Hmm.
Okay, he probably has no benefits like he had at $19 an hour. So even though we have this wonderful, robust economy, we have this high unemployment rate, we have tons of our community that are in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a nonprofit sector that's trying to meet that. At the same time, their funds are being cut. So you have – you talk about a potential – that's your explosion point. Now, we won't see it as a sector issue. We'll see it as breakdowns in community.
Societal issue.
Societal issues, mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah.
That's your challenge.
Not to mention that nobody's saved retirement in this country, too. And what is that going to look like?
So the dilemma is this supply and demand issue for the sector. And again, I don't think you'll see it as disruption per se to the sector, but you'll see forced consolidations. Okay. You can see that coming. You're going to see organizations – they don't – unfortunately, they don't perish, but they will just be mitigated. They'll be just really relegated to a very different stature in their community.
Yeah, yeah. You know, but, I hear what you say.
But you're going to see a lot of – I would argue the disruption is going on, and we don't see it.
Sure. That's usually disruption is. Right. It happens, and then all of a sudden it explodes, and it's sort of like an overnight sensation.
Watch any northern city today and watch the degree of private schools being shut down because of demographic changes.
Yeah, yeah. I always look at these organizations, too, and they, as you say, they don't disappear. They seem to lose about 3 to 5% of their relevance every year, and
right.
Then pretty soon they're no longer here.
Right.
Well, Mario Marino, the chairman of the Marino Institute, I want to thank you so much for being here this evening. Tell us about your website and what might be useful to individuals or organizations that come there for a visit.
Well, visit leapambassadors.org. That's the URL for the Leap Ambassadors community. And you'll see information like the performance imperative. You mentioned something that we're bringing out that's really a product renamed called the performance practice that puts the performance imperative into use. There's many different articles you can use in your area today, and hopefully some supporting material that you can take away as an executive director or board member to help you in your job.
Well, thanks, Mario. It was so nice to have you on the program.
Thank you, Denver.
I'll be back with more of The Business of Giving right after this.
The Business of Giving can be heard every Sunday evening between 6 and 7 p.m. Eastern on AM 970 The Answer in New York and on iHeartRadio. You can follow us at Biz of Give on Twitter and at Facebook.com/Business of Giving.
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.